Hello, and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief of the Security Ledger. In this 67th episode of the podcast, we're going to talk about RAC, the flaw found in the Wi-Fi Protected Access Wireless Security Standard, with Bob Rudess of the firm Rapid7. Bob will tell us what steps consumers and businesses can take to protect themselves. Also, when Akamai Technologies had its annual Edge conference last week in Las Vegas, bots were on the agenda. We're going to talk with Orcats of Akamai about the company's research that found that embedded devices like home routers play a big part in what are known as fast flux botnets. And finally, how does a software vulnerability end up spread across millions of applications? We're going to talk with Tim Jarrett of the firm Veracode about research his company did on open source software reuse and supply chain risk. But first, with a major security vulnerability revealed in the technology that millions of wireless networks use to protect the integrity of communications, Bob Rudess of the firm Rapid7 tells us that patching the flaw won't be easy and that wireless users should take other steps to protect themselves. In this conversation, I asked Bob to start out by explaining just what the RAC vulnerability is all about.
My name is Bob Rudess, and I'm chief data scientist at Rapid7. So what the attackers figured out how to do is, in the initial exchange between clients and Wi-Fi access points, there's a handshake to cause a unique set of keys to be used between those, the client and the access point. Because when you reuse keys, it's a lot easier to break the encryption. These guys figured out how to, in one of those parts of the exchange, cause the keys to be used are the same. So in other words, multiple sets of connections use the exact same key. And the minute you have more than one bit of communication using the same key, so two or more, it's easy for knowledgeable folks in cryptography to break that encryption so they can pretty much read what's on the wire or in the airwaves in this case. And they might be able to, in some cases, also inject traffic, so change the contents of those packets. So not only have they figured out a way to break confidentiality on Wi-Fi networks, they've also potentially figured out a way to let attackers change messages on those Wi-Fi networks as well, too. So it's a pretty impressive vulnerability that they found in WPA. So the first thing that attackers need for this is proximity to your wireless network. This is not a remote attack. There's no one from across the globe going to be attacking you across the rest of the part of the globe. They've got to be able to be where you are and be able to do and sense and see your wireless access point. So I think that's the first one. And a lot of people that I've seen online have been a little bit more scared that this was a wider kind of a vulnerability. This is an absolutely very close proximity attack they need to do. It's basically a man-in-the-middle attack, so they have to trick the whole setup that you've got to kind of clone your access point, have you talk to both access points at the same time or over the course of a series of messages. That is not a trivial thing to do. There are experienced folks who do vulnerability assessments for a living. They might have the technology or eventually have it, because there's no real proof of concept that we've seen in the wild for this yet. The researchers have something, but we haven't seen code. We haven't seen anything exploiting this right now. But you would really need a level of sophistication as an attacker to be able to just start doing this attack. And then even when you start doing this attack, there is no guarantee of success every time you do this. So you have to do a lot of tricking. You have to put yourself in the right network position. You have to have a lot of things aligned properly for this to really be a significant issue. We don't want to downplay the potential severity of this, because it can absolutely be an issue. And there will most likely be, over the course of time, tool sets developed that will make this be something that more folks can adopt, more folks can use, that less sophisticated attackers will be able to use and guarantee some success rates that are higher than they're going to be now. But for right now, this requires a pretty smart attacker in a really good position, very determined to do what they're going to do. And there's going to be some luck involved as well, too, because they're not going to be able to successfully accomplish what they're trying to do as they do this attack. They're going to have to try it multiple times to do something. And even then, when they do accomplish it, they may only be able to get certain types of packets, certain numbers of packets, and they may not be able to impact the integrity of the connections as well, too. So you're hearing all those caveats, and they're there for a reason. This is not trivial. This is not easy. It is a problem.
And you raise the issue yourself. The effect of this or its impact is different depending on the platform. Is that right? Or the implementation of WPA2?
That is correct. So there are many ways that you can configure WPA. And I don't want to lose the fact that WPA 1 is also impacted, because there's the kind of the home version of WPA and the enterprise version of WPA. And they're really both impacted but by the same thing. Yet some clients, because this is primarily a client issue, although you can make changes and the way that the access points are configured can be done in such a way that can help make this not be as much of a vulnerability in the short term. But it really is a fundamental flaw. And some of the things that you can do to configure WPA, you can try to do some things to be able to make WPA a little bit more robust. But the reality is until there's a patch made for how this key exchange is made and validated, there really is no short-term fix to this except for wait for a patch to be able to do something.
And you know, Bob, whenever there's a problem, I'm always wondering who is to blame and who I can point my finger at. who is to blame in this case? It seems like this is an implementation of an 802.11 technology. Where did the fault happen? And I guess the corollary to that is, what is the fix?
So I'm very careful to not call out any particular person, org, or whatever, because this is kind of bigger than just a, ooh, who did this or what did this. I think one of the fundamental issues was a lot of really, really smart folks, like way smarter than I am, worked on coming up with this standard for both the key exchange and all the different nuances that you can do with encryption and data transmission over WPA. And there was a huge number of folks involved in looking at the mathematical proof for the security of this key exchange setup. The math works great, except the big problem is the math can be great, but the implementation of the math or how the different stacks are created on the client side and on the access point side to enable all that math to be working in real life is where I think that this comes down to. And I think it was really not so the math is great. How the algorithms were all defined were great. I don't think the implementations of these algorithms were threat modeled sufficiently over time to be able to catch this particular thing. And I think that's really what it comes down to. It's just trusting that the math can take care of everything when you really got to have that combination of the math and the implementation of the math to really ensure that this is going to work right. The one thing I tweeted earlier today, I think the main TLDR on this entire crack thing is that cryptography is hard, and cryptography is absolutely hard.
Yeah.
And that's one of the key problems with it's just, you know, not marrying the math with the implementation of the math.
So Microsoft says it has already patched supported versions of Windows for this flaw in an update that's already gone out. Other platforms, Android, some Linux, the patches are still forthcoming. As you said, it affects both WPA1, which is more common in like home wireless networks, and WPA2, which is more common on business networks. If people are reading this, either business owners, IT administrators, homeowners, and kind of freaking out about it, what should they be doing? And are there interim workarounds as they wait for whomever their vendor is to patch us?
So on the organization side, because there are some things that organizations can do that home users really, really can't do for this. And on the organization side, the recommendation is ironically something that a lot of cybersecurity folks have been recommending ever since Wi-Fi got created, you know, and was deployed as a thing, which is treat all Wi-Fi networks. It doesn't matter what the protocol is. It doesn't matter what is being used to secure the Wi-Fi connection itself. But treat all Wi-Fi networks as hostile. You know, they basically treat them like they're the Wild West, treat them like they're the Internet, and make sure that when users connect to the Wi-Fi, even your organization's Wi-Fi, that they have to VPN in to get to the resources, and that all other company resources are either provided via VPN or over HTTPS channels. I think that's one of the main messages for org is take this as an opportunity to not just wait for the patches to come from the vendors, but think about re-architecting how you do Wi-Fi access. And there's some more technical things that people can come up with to do it too, but the VPN is I would say, quickest and most straightforward one for folks to do there. For the home users, or like maybe just the individual user first before we go to the home folks, If you do anything over public Wi-Fi, so if you go to a coffee shop or an airport or you're on a train, do your research and pick a VPN vendor that you can trust and use that whenever you're on public Wi-Fi. If you really can't afford that or you can't do that, some of the extensions that try to ensure you're using HTTPS everywhere, and when you're on public Wi-Fi networks, do not use anything but those secure connections, because the VPN layer and the SSL layer, the TLS layer, they really... that's a second layer of encryption that the attackers can't break through, at least that we know of yet. I mean, there was the RSA problem earlier today, too, as a news item, so who knows where that's going to go with there. I think, but from a home user perspective, There's two problems there, right? Like people have a lot of Wi-Fi kit in their house, whether it's IoT devices, their phones, their laptops, their tablets, their televisions, all sorts of things like that. You know, so there's a lot of complexity with how they have their things configured. And a lot of folks don't deploy their own Wi-Fi access points. They trust the internet service provider to provide that as something that's part of the service that they get from them. So I think if you haven't purchased and supplied your own Wi-Fi device, you know, today, just email, call, however you engage with support with your internet service provider, and ask them what their plans are to fix this. And if they don't have plans to fix this, ask for a new device, or potentially replace that device with something of your own. And that's not a trivial task for a lot of people. I understand that, but it is something that they could do. If you have supplied your own equipment, at a minimum, start by fixing what you can on your operating system. Sorry, right? Update your devices when patches come out. Update your phones, tablets, laptops, et cetera. Try to double check all your IoT stuff, you know, your, like anything, your thermostats, your refrigerators, whatever you've got connected to your televisions. Try to see if there's updates for those things as well too, because they're probably going to be the things that get patched last by vendors if they get patched at all. And then finally, if you've bought Wi-Fi access points on your own, make sure you're checking the vendor site for patches for those things. And frankly, if a vendor hasn't updated their Wi-Fi access point firmware or operating system software within about a week, I would suggest going somewhere and getting a different version of that, or a new version, or a whole new device that actually does have support for that. This isn't something you want to mess around, especially if you're in a densely populated metropolitan area. Because while this is a difficult attack for attackers to successfully accomplish, the reality is that some attackers will be able to do this. It will eventually become something more commodity, and you don't want to be the one with a network that is susceptible to something like this.
Bob Rudess of Rapid7, thanks so much for coming in and speaking with the Security Ledger podcast.
It was great talking with you.
Up next, the Mirai botnet got lots of headlines, but Orr Katz of the firm Akamai said an even bigger threat comes from so-called fast flux botnets that are harder to spot and stamp out. Using web domains and shifting ranks of infected devices, these botnets morph and evade detection, sometimes for years. To begin our conversation, Orr explained for us how fast flux botnets work and how they're different from traditional botnets.
Well, fast flux is a technique being used by botnets in order to become agile, undetected, and long-lived. Mm-hmm. The basic concept is that each botnet is being compounded out of many resources. Those resources have IP addresses. Now, a botnet network will use domain names in order to communicate with those IP addresses, but it's constantly changing the relation between those domain names and the associated IP addresses. Mm-hmm. And more than that, it takes all those domain names and changes them also frequently. So when you try to track that botnet, it's very hard to do that.
Okay. So the hosts associated with the botnet are constantly changing. Their address, their identity is shifting constantly.
Exactly.
How is that different from a botnet like Mirai or BrickerBot that people might have heard of?
The difference is that when you try to put your hands on that botnet, it's very hard to do that. Like Mirai will do a lot of communication toward IP addresses, and a FastFlex botnet will use domain name, meaning malware will try to communicate with domain names, and those domain names hold a lot of different IP addresses, meaning different resources behind them. Now, when you will try to track the domain and the IP addresses, once you will do that, the FastFlex network will change, and those domains will change, and those associated IPs will change. So in a way, the network is constantly changing.
You liken these fast flux botnets to living organisms. Talk about that.
Well, as I just described, well, when you think about it, it's like the network is constantly evolving. We measured a lot of things on those networks. For example, we tried to measure how much of the IP addresses that associated on that network is being changed over time. And when we scaled it on 4 weeks of data, we were able to see that 80% of the botnet actually changed in terms of IP addresses that associated with it. So you can also refer to that as a living organism that constantly changed, that constantly evolved. And well, that's the meaning for that.
And is that being done programmatically, or is that being done more or less manually by the people who are operating the botnet, those types of changes?
So it depends on the botnet, but from my understanding and from the evidence that we were able to collect, There is another component in that network, which are the name server. A name server will hold domain names and the associated IPs for those domain names. So when a malicious actor wants to run such network, what he will do, he will have a dedicated name server, and that name server will hold domain names and associated IPs, and it will constantly change. So this is the part of that network when you control all those elements and the changes of that network.
So you've said that these FastFlux botnets are kind of part of or behind the scenes for a lot of malignant infrastructure and activity online. You've linked them to, in your research, to dark markets, to web-based attacks, and you know, other types of infrastructure, phishing websites, and so on. Why is that? How do these end up being the platform of choice for all these different types of scams and schemes?
I think as I began explaining about the FastFlux botnet, is the fact that we know that those botnets are very hard to be detected. Therefore, they are long-lived. So when you think about it as in terms of the service that those botnets deliver to their customer, which are bad guys that try to host malwares or try to execute all kind of attacks, they have a service that is stable. And in many ways, that's why it is highly popular and highly used by many or variety of different malicious services, as mm-hmm. you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Given that these are constantly changing and shifting, how do you identify them? You said that just looking for malicious behavior and spotting the, you know, identifying the botnet just based on it doing bad things is not a particularly effective approach.
So the FastFlux has, well, some sort of a behavior that you can classify as malicious activity. You don't need to look on the evidence of malicious activity. You can look on the FastFlux behavior, the fluctuation of those botnets. And actually, that's highly related to Akamai and the visibility that we have for data. We have visibility to web data because Akamai is, well, the biggest CDN network in the world. But more to that, recently we have a new line of product that has visibility to enterprise-related traffic. And when we combine that together, when we classify all the data that we have, we actually can create an algorithm that know how to identify FastFlux behavior. And by that, we actually be able to catch those domain names that are constantly changing, that has a lot of related IP addresses to them that are like reemerge and then die. And by doing that, we have the ability to identify the network.
So you said a lot of the hosts that are in this particular botnet, and it was, I think, around 14,000 hosts who were part of this FastFlux botnet that you identified, mm-hmm. were in Russia, former Soviet republics. What do we know about the systems that end up being a part of a FastFlux botnet like this?
First of all, we see that those hosts are usually part of all kind of ISP in, as you said, Romania, mainly on Russia, Romania, and Ukraine. And we know that those hosts are home router. And we looked into all kind of information that related to those hosts, and we were able to see that a lot of ports that are open on those hosts are not expected to be open. For example, if you can see on a home router a port number 80 or 443, which are representing web server, that's not a legit kind of behavior, right? Because on a home router, you won't see web servers. It's not expected. Definitely not on a large amount of those hosts being on that network. So in a way, we collected a lot of evidences that when we connected all the dots together, gave us the understanding that this is truly a long-living botnet that is, well, as I said, constantly changing and have a lot of properties of being malicious, a lot of evidences for being malicious.
You noticed in part of your research that there was a system on one of your enterprise customers who was communicating out to this botnet. So it seems like these are not only kind of external threats to your organization, but might also be correlated with suspicious activity within an organization.
Yes, we had two evidences inside of Akamai indicating that there is malicious activity. We also were able to see a lot of activity out there publicly available. First of all, we were able to see one of our customers, and we monitor those. We have an enterprise security threat protector customer that we constantly monitor all the traffic that goes from their enterprise to Akamai Cloud. And we were able to see that there are some activity to a domain that we know that was classified as part of a botnet. And once we tracked that, we were also able to see the actual HTTP traffic that goes from that customer to a given domain with a very specific URL. We looked at that URL and we were able to see that that URL actually contained a malware binary file. And that's one part of the story. The second part of the story is, since we have visibility to web traffic, we were able to see a lot of traffic going out of the Fastlock botnet and targeting a lot of Akamai's customers. And, well, with the variety of web attacks such as credential abuse attacks or even harvesting of a lot of data. So we had two types of evidences that tied together the story.
Is there any evidence that these are for hire? In other words, that people just operate Fastlux botnets as a service, more or less? Or are they generally just part of the toolkit that a cyber criminal group will use to carry out an attack?
We didn't find any specific evidences that were gave us the ability to tie those, you know, the assumption that this botnet is being offered as a service to the public, to whatever want to use it. But we know that such networks and the behavior of the malicious activities on that network represent bulletproof kind of network that hosts a lot of malicious services for rent.
Final question. Is there any easy way to make this particular problem of Fastlux botnets go away? It's very hard to regulate or control what domain somebody can register or what IP addresses they can associate with that domain. It's hard to go into other countries and shut down these devices that might be susceptible to being hacked. So is this just kind of like malaria or something? It's like an endemic problem on the internet that we're never going to get rid of?
You know, theoretically, we can say that we need to reach out to all those places that host a lot of malicious activities and work with authorities and governments to take them down. But realistically, it's not that simple. And in a way, I think it can be solved with security solutions. Security solution that looks into traffic, that look into HTTP and DNS traffic, and know to find those domains and classify them as malicious. And by, you know, if you had a service that will find those domains and will make sure that all the traffic that goes out of your organization is not malicious, I think you have a solution in your hand.
Orkatz of Akamai, thank you so much for coming in and talking to the Security Ledger podcast.
Thanks, Paul. It's
and finally, Apache Commons Collections is an unremarkable open source toolkit, but like the tiny krill at the bottom of the food chain, Apache Commons Collections and the serious software security hole have ended up as a component of thousands of other open source projects and literally millions of software applications that rely on them. In this week's podcast, we sat down with Tim Jarrett of the firm Veracode to talk about his company's research into the Apache Commons Collections family tree.
Hi, this is Tim Jarrett. I'm Director of Product Management at CA Veracode. What we were trying to get at was understanding why it is that we seem to see a lot of applications with vulnerabilities that stem from their use of open source code. And the research that we did was trying to just get a map of the world of component usage. And often the idea is you want to grab a piece of code that somebody else has written so that your application can take advantage of that functionality yourself. The author of that code will presumably have thought of more potential problems that you might run into and cover more edge cases than you ever would think of if you did, you know, this code on your own. And so, you know, we see a lot of, especially Java applications, using lots of different open source components. And one of the components that was on the top of the list was this thing called Apache Commons Collections. And this is just a little utility library that Java developers use to work with collections of data. Other programming languages can call these things like structures or something like that. But it's basically a way to manipulate information that's coming from outside the application and work with it. And we couldn't understand why there were so many applications that used this one library. What we found was that it was used by a lot of other open source packages. And so that really led us to our hypothesis, which is, you know, the reason that a lot of applications have some of these components in them is that the developers have actually no idea that they're there. They will be picking some other piece of open source functionality, a library or framework, and this component just comes along with it. And, you know, from a security perspective, that actually starts to become pretty problematic, and that's part of what the research showed.
And what does Apache Commons Collection do?
It's what I think of as kind of a handyman library. And the idea is that you use it or you use the functionality in it just to make working with data easier. There's a lot of these libraries in the Java ecosystem that programmers have developed to make life easier for the average Java developer. And Commons Collections is part of a family of those utility libraries, the Apache Commons family, that is kind of like functionality that in the opinion of the open source developers who wrote and maintain it, that every project, a product should have that accessible to it. It makes it easier for developers to work with data to manage data that's in a collection, to compare two collections together and other operations that a developer would need to do on data that's in some sort of structured format.
And we know from, you know, Heartbleed that even some very heavily used open source projects and software sometimes aren't getting the attention they need from developers, especially on security. What's Apache Commons Collection's story? Has it been well maintained and actively maintained? Are there a lot of eyes, as it were, looking at the underlying code?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. The fact is that it's a well-run project that maintains this code. There haven't been a lot of updates to it. It's a fairly mature library. But once the thing that we wrote about in the report was identified in, I think this was like October 2015 or so, the community kind of jumped into action and released new versions of the software very, very quickly. I think it was like a 5-day kind of lag between the release of a patch from the initial identification for one of the two active branches of development and another. So, you know, the community was fairly on top of things. Based on the data that we've seen in both last year's Data Software Security Report and what we're seeing as we're preparing the next version, it appears that developers don't adopt new patches for the open source libraries that they have in their applications once they're available. We look at the distribution of the numbers of applications that are on each of these library versions. There's no correlation between whether there's a vulnerability identified in the code and whether the application actually gets updated to a newer version of the library. So it really doesn't seem to matter whether the open source project teams are patching or not, or are releasing patches or not, if the development teams never adopt the patches into their applications.
So you did this family tree. You found that there were 5 generations of software components that use the Apache Commons Collection libraries. And you said more than 80,000 have this version 3.2.1 vulnerability, which again dates from 2015. That those 80,000 components are used in millions of software programs.
Right. And this was what was most striking to us when we looked at the data. The data that we are citing in this family tree study was current as of, you know, kind of when we put the report together, based on the data that's in the Maven shared repository for all this open source Java libraries. And it actually very clearly kind of traces the dependency, so we can tell what open source packages use what versions. And what was striking to us was just, you know, by the virtue of the fact that Commons Collections was included in a couple of really high profile open source projects or frameworks like Velocity, which is used for user interface across probably hundreds of thousands of Java applications, or Hibernate, which is used by 1,100 other well-known open source projects, and then in a couple thousand or tens of thousands of Java applications beyond that, that this library becomes very pervasive very quickly. There's some caveats on the widespread nature of this library, in that not every application or open source framework that embeds it will necessarily be vulnerable to the problem that was open source project patched Commons collections for.
Right.
What researchers found was that if you were using that library in a particular way in an application that took a certain type of input from the outside world, in the form of a Java object, and then the program accepted that object without checking anything about it, that the application could be exploited. There were a lot of applications that may not have practiced this sort of, they call it unsafe deserialization, which is another word for the unflattening of these objects. And so those applications may legitimately have been okay not to patch, but it's also a very, very prevalent practice in Java development to do this sort of deserialization of data over the wire. We've seen, more than 25% of every Java application that Veracode has tested does this sort of unsafe deserialization. It's a very common practice.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that these things aren't being patched is a matter of some real concern.
It almost, when you look at the family tree and sort of consider the numbers, it's almost like an epidemiologic model in terms of how this flaw spreads, right, from this original source to its kind of children and the children of those children in some ways, the the many software development projects that use one of these many different Apache components or libraries that in turn use ACC. What is the, and we know how difficult it is to fix, biological problems, diseases and so on.
Yeah.
What is the fix here in the software context? Can we take any lessons from epidemiology in terms of how to address this?
I think there are actually two relevant metaphors that come to mind that will. Certainly epidemiology, what you're concerned about is rate of infection, but also rate of cure. And I think that based on what we know about the use of open source libraries, this isn't like malware. This is application code or software code that has legitimate, business use, business value. And the problem with it is not something inherently wrong with this code. The problem is that over time, people find bugs in this software. And I think that what that tends us to focus our attention on is not, can we stop the use of open source software? Because I don't think that's the right answer. I don't think that's the right question to be asking. I think that, maybe a more helpful metaphor for it is to think about this in terms of financial accounting and basically a balance sheet, and think about developers taking in functionality, which goes on certainly the asset side of their software. It gets them to market faster, but there's an accrued debt that the teams are taking on by taking in this open source code that they need to periodically pay down in terms of making sure that the software that they're using is still free over time as the landscape changes and vulnerabilities are found, is still free from vulnerabilities. And if development teams don't make these debt payments, it's not uncommon for things to get to the point where now there's a really bad vulnerability and patching it takes a really long time because there's so much difference between the version of the software that you're using and the most current version that's actually been patched. And I've actually had engineers talk about this as component bankruptcy, where they actually end up having to completely junk something that they've done and rewrite something because it's faster than trying to figure out how to just outright adopt the latest patch. So if we're thinking about it in financial terms, I think the advice that we would give is number one, be aware of the problem. Actually keep your balance sheets. Understand what the components are that you're actually using. And agree on what accounting principles you're using. You know, are you going to worry about every vulnerability that's identified? You know, maybe not. Maybe you want to focus on the ones that have a particular score that will trip a level and cause the engineering teams to engage and pay attention. I think, you know, having education around the concept of actually staying current and what the threat landscape is really helpful. So making sure that not just the security team, but the developers are aware of this issue. And then, you know, just as you have periodic checks and balances built into financial accounting in the form of, you know, earning statements and you know, quarterly reports and that sort of thing, making sure that the development team has a mechanism whereby they can continually check what's going on as they make changes, and then also once those applications are in production. And that can be done through automation. Is the good news. It's not something where you have to do a lot of manual work. And I think, you know, that combined with just a shift in the mindset and a recognition that, you know, open source components are free, but there's also a carrying cost with them. I like to think of it as it's not free as in beer, which is the common thing that people talk about in connection with open source. It's more like, you know, it's free like a puppy. You are going to have to you know, pay attention over time and not just assume that it's always going to be there. You have to periodically check and see if it's got any needs that you need to take care of. You know, again, this is not, you know, open source is bad. I think that in 2017, it's a really unrealistic position to take. I think the important thing for everybody to understand is that security is not about, you know, people being dumb or not doing, you know, or doing, you know, bad things deliberately. This is just a question of understanding realistically what the threat landscape is out there and making sure that you're taking the right actions to stay protected. I think of it more as common sense than anything else. And hopefully with, you know, infographics like the one that we've produced, we're helping more people see it as a common sense thing that they need to do.
Tim Jarrett of Veracode CA, thank you so much for coming on and speaking with the Security Ledger podcast.
Thanks, Paul. Pleasure as always.